Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Bill Hardy with AIDS Resource Center Ohio gives us an update on HIV and AIDS here in the state of Ohio, and he'll also talk about Truvada, the new HIV prevention drug recently approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Also, award-winning author and assistant professor at Sinclair Community College, Trudy Krischer, reads from her novel, Kinship. Our series of readings from the Antioch Writers' Workshop begins today. In our weekly series road trip, we're on our way to Cleveland to explore Little Italy with producer Karen Schaefer. Plus, Emily McCord has this week's Politics Ohio. Up first, during the 1970s, a new genre of music called funk was making its way into the American mainstream, and Dayton, Ohio was at the epicenter. Community Voices producer Basim Blunt says that more funk bands came from Dayton than any other place in the world. In this story, we'll hear about the world-famous funk bands that hailed from the city's west side and discover one community's attempt to honor their legacy before the music fades.
I used to watch the Ohio players practice when I was a kid in a garage.
Pain is in my heart. Stand me apart, yeah.
I'm a funketeer. I'll be a funketeer for life. Because it was part of me, and I'm a part of that era. I love funk.
That's Daytonian Harold Rimblett Jr., a true funketeer. Me, I'm not from Dayton. I'm from Jersey City, a subway stop from the Big Apple and music nirvana. Growing up in the 70s, Dayton, Ohio was nowhere on my radar, but funk music sure was. It was the soundtrack of Afro Sheen commercials and Brown Skin Honeys doing the bump on Soul Train. On the weekends, me and my crew stood in line for hours to see groups like Slave, Heatwave, the Ohio Players, and Lakeside set New York on fire. Those were the days. Fast forward 30 years and I find myself with a wife, house, and kids and living where else? In Dayton, Ohio. How could I have known that one day I would be meeting many of my music idols at the local Walmart? What's more amazing is that there's no trace of Dayton's music history within the city. So now I'm like, what the funk is going on? Ohio Players were the first band to set it off in a big way. The 1974 record, Skin Tight, went gold and held number one on the charts for 7 weeks. The Players were Dayton's first music superstars.
You are bad, bad misses, and them skin tight riches, running folks in ditches.
Bassist Marshall Jones is one of the original Ohio Players. He is Bass Buddha, the Tony Soprano of the bass clef.
I'm the one that made that famous song, and I get emails from all over the world of bass players are telling me about how they was impressed and that they grew up on my music and so forth. Because I wasn't that crazy about Skin Tight. I wanted to change some parts in it, and he said, no, man, that's the groove.
The Players were on fire. They followed up Skin Tight with a streak of 4 number one hits, 2 Grammy nominations, and a European tour. Marshall says that staying in Dayton allowed the Players to mentor to the next generation of musicians who are hungry for a taste of fame.
Dayton has kept us grounded. We were stars to the world, but Dayton was our home. We were a true show band. All of the musicians, even though they were in school and learning, they had a world-class show band as a model. That's why so many groups came up out of Dayton.
One of those groups, Slave, was formed when Players trumpeter Pee Wee Middlebrooks brought his talented young nephew, Stevie Washington, to Dayton.
But Steve Washington lived in Jersey, and he was in his senior year in high school. So we did a performance in Newark, New Jersey, and Steve came to the show, and he begged his mama, I want to go back with my Uncle Pee Wee. So little Stevie came to Dayton, and he started Slave in Pee Wee's basement. Next thing you know, they're making hit records. Hits, I mean hits. And we weren't even taking them serious because they were teenagers.
Slave's first single, Slide, was an instant funk classic. It featured a groove driven by Mark Adams' signature slap bass sound. Sam Carter played keyboards for Slave and explains why the band's songs were so dance floor friendly.
People like to dance, particularly in the African American community. They like the freedom of dancing and expressing themselves, and funk gave a strong platform for that. The music scene here was very strong.
The Ohio Players were responsible for yet another Dayton discovery when sax player Clarence Satchel discovered the house band at a local nightclub. That group was called Fazo. Keyboard player Keith Harrison remembers that evening.
We did our last gig at the Red Barn, and Satch was there. And he was in a one-piece leather jumpsuit. And after we finished, he said, "I want to take you guys in the studio. If you're interested, be over at my house tomorrow." We went to Satch the next morning. We sat in his driveway, I think, man, for about 3 hours before he came out. And he said, "I was testing y'all to see how bad did you want it."
Riding High stayed on the Billboard charts for an amazing 18 weeks and is still one of the most sampled songs in hip-hop. The group Heatwave was formed by brothers Keith and Johnny Wilder. They combined funk with disco on the multi-platinum selling Boogie Nights. And the hit-making band Lakeside struck gold with their single Fantastic Voyage, which was the first R&B record to record a rap performance.
Hey, come on, take the ride. There's a party over there that ain't no job. It's live, it's all the way live.
Way before Nicki Minaj and Lady Gaga, Dayton funk bands offered a visual stage show of costumes that were part Las Vegas and part sci-fi. One band that combined musicianship and showmanship was Roger Troutman and Zapp. Janetta Warren sang background on the band's debut smash, More Bounce to the Ounce.
Outfits we wore back then, the costumes. Today, the artists just walk up on stage in a pair of jeans and a shirt. That's not how it should be done.
Zapp ushered in the 80s with a techno-funk sound and Roger Troutman's trademark talk box that handled the vocals and melodies.
Roger really loved my voice because I could hit all the notes that he hit on the talk box, you know, being the techno sound and everything. And I just kind of matched him a lot, and so he really, really loved that.
In 1998, Michael Sampson was the first one to curate a museum exhibit that was dedicated to the Dayton funk scene. It was called Something in the Water.
Dayton loved these bands. They felt that these groups identified with them personally. The musicians, a lot of them have not received their due. They should. It did not have to be that we were the home of this powerful brand of music.
It's been more than 10 years since the Something in the Water exhibit closed. Now Sampson has partnered with the city's Wright Dunbar Neighborhood District Association and is planning to open up what will be called the Atlanta Funk Hall of Fame this fall. Michael takes me on a walk through the Wright Dunbar District. It's a revitalized section of 3rd Street. This is the street where the Atlanta Funk Hall of Fame plans to open in October 2012.
The subject matter is exciting. The music is exciting. We want the exhibition to be exciting. We're going to have posters. We're going to have photographs. And what we're going to do.
They say all things funk come from West Dayton. This is where it all happened. I hope Dayton can realize that fans from all over the world revere the music that came from this city. And what happened here was something that will never happen again. For Community Voices, this is Basim Blunt.
What? Say it now. Say it now. Yeah. Me and the Ohio Players gonna tell you about a worm.
For more information about WISO's Community Voices project, visit WISO.org and sign up for our mailing list. Join us each Tuesday and Sunday for more new works from WISO's latest Community Voices producers. This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. In our weekly series Road Trip, radio producers from around the state take you on audio tours from the new Ohio Guide. Today, we take to the streets of Cleveland to explore Little Italy with producer Karen Schaefer. It's part of a tour of Cleveland's ethnic neighborhoods along U.S. Route 20.
Walk the steep, narrow streets of Cleveland's Little Italy, and you're in another world. Italian opera spills from a corner restaurant, while across the street, patrons at a sidewalk cafe munch cannoli with their cappuccino. Cleveland native and Italian tour guide Diana Maiola Cirino says Little Italy was an ideal location for Italian immigrants who began arriving here in 1885.
You know, Italians have always lived in small hilltop towns, sometimes surrounded by walls, and created their own little communities that could take on a lot of dimension with a lot of people, and that's what they found here.
Little Italy is Cleveland's most enduring Italian neighborhood. In 1911, more than 90% of its residents were Italian-born. Angelo Vitantonio invented the first hand-cranked pasta machine here in 1906. The neighborhood is still known for its authentic Italian restaurants, most focusing on the cuisine of Italy's southern regions.
Molise, Napoli, no, the area of Napoli, and southern Italy, Calabria and Sicily. Usually southern immigrants left Italy for hope and a better life in America in that case.
That's Francesca Mignosa, who works for Cirino. She came here from her native Sicily for college a few years ago. Mignosa stops in front of Holy Rosary Church, which holds outdoor processions during the four-day street festival of the Feast of the Assumption in mid-August. She says for Cleveland's Italian Americans, religion and education go hand in hand.
And education is a constant, and we're in front of actually the Montessori School of Holy Rosary. Maria Montessori was, you know, an Italian educator that came to the U.S. and established this new way of teaching or educating, which was not actually based on structure, but on following, you know, a child's own development.
After the unification of Italy, more than 25,000 immigrants came to Cleveland. That story is told in a mural on the lower end of Mayfield Road. At the top of the street is Alta House, a settlement house founded in 1895 by John D. Rockefeller. Here, local residents still play bocce, a bowling game that dates back to Roman times. Cleveland resident Valerio Frabotta has been playing since he was a young man in Italy.
It's a little competition, you know. Yeah, it's a lot of challenge. We go to Toronto, New York, everywhere. Yeah, it's a good, I have fun. It's a good game. You can play until you're my old age already.
Italians brought more than bocce to Cleveland. Pamela DeRazio-Dean, associate curator of Italian-American history at the Western Reserve Historical Society, says Cleveland's Italian immigrant stonemasons literally helped build the city.
People look at buildings like Severance Hall every day. They go in and admire the beauty of the building, not realizing anywhere you look in the city, any of the stonework done, there's a 90% chance that an Italian immigrant had his hand in that work.
Another Italian tradition has made its way here as well.
Passeggiata, o passeggio.
It's a beautiful part of the day, for sure.
And I think it also goes back to the concept of enjoying la dolce vita, which, you know, dolce vita means sweet life.
Enjoying life in Little Italy is a year-round affair. In October, the neighborhood hosts a Columbus Day parade, and Little Italy's many galleries sponsor art walks in June, October, and December. In Cleveland, I'm Karen Schaefer.
You can download the new Ohio Guide tours at seeohiofirst.org. The new Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Recently, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved a preventative drug for HIV. The drug is called Truvada, and I spoke with Bill Hardy of AIDS Resource Center Ohio about the new treatment.
Truvada is the first FDA-approved non-surgical biomedical treatment in a decade aimed at reducing sexual transmission of HIV or reception of HIV in those who are HIV negative, and that's the twist here.
So people are going to have to be aware of the status anyway.
That is correct.
And so is there any concern that people won't use this drug properly?
You know, one of the concerns from folks who are opposed to the use of this as PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, is the fear that people will see it as a silver bullet, people will stop using condoms, and will stop using HIV prevention methods. So the point is, Truvada must be used with other traditional mechanisms like condom use and testing, and it does have to be taken daily.
Well, let's talk about the effectiveness.
Yeah, based on what we've seen in the research, and they've been doing research on Truvada for decades, but 96% effective is what the research has shown thus far.
Last week, the International AIDS Conference took place. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, there was all kinds of good news, exciting news coming out of the International AIDS Conference. And I think the takeaway, remarkably, is that the researchers and the scientists are now saying that we have the science, not the cure, but the science to end the AIDS epidemic as we now know it. And the question, of course, is do we have the will and do we have the resources to stop the epidemic? The strategy is test and treat. One in five individuals in the United States who are HIV positive still do not know that they're HIV infected, so we want to test those folks. We've got to reach them, and they have to find out that they're HIV positive. Having said that, once they are diagnosed, we need to treat them. We now know that with early diagnosis and treatment, a person is 96% less likely to transmit the virus, and with early treatment and early diagnosis, that we can expect them to live just about as long as an uninfected individual, and we could not have imagined that just a few years ago.
I'm curious, where are the highest rates of infection in the state?
Well, actually, Columbus has the highest rate of new infections, and Columbus is the 21st highest rate of infections in the country. So in Columbus, the capital of Ohio, there's a new HIV infection every 25 hours or less. So, again, many of our prevention and testing and medical outreach programs are focusing in on the state's capital right now.
And so give us a picture of what's taking place here in the Miami Valley.
Sure. Well, AIDS Resource Center Ohio continues to focus on testing and outreach and prevention activities and treatment. We continue to focus on those populations most impacted and to bring them into care with local health care providers. And happily, AIDS Resource Center Ohio's Dayton office is now the home office for an organization that has 11 offices across the state. So we are the leading AIDS organization in the state of Ohio. And this year, thanks to community support, we will provide assistance to some 3,500 HIV-positive individuals, and will reach tens of thousands of others with prevention and testing programs.
Bill Hardy, President and CEO of AIDS Resource Center Ohio, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, as always, for your support.
And if you have questions regarding HIV or AIDS, visit arcohio.org. They've got all kinds of information there for you. This is WISO Weekend. Last month, a week-long Antioch Writers' Workshop was held in Yellow Springs. Faculty members and published authors held nightly readings at Antioch University Midwest. And for the next month, we'll be airing excerpts from some of those readings here on WISO Weekend. Our first reading is from Trudy Krischer, an award-winning author and assistant professor at Sinclair Community College. This year, she served as the instructor for the young writers attending the workshop. Here she reads from her novel Kinship, which is set in a South Georgia trailer park in the 1960s. It's the story of a young girl named Pert Wilson, told through the voices of her neighbors.
This is the first trailer park voice. This is Alice Potter, who is in trailer 2. The bottles on my bottle tree is just like family. They got names and stories. My bottles is beautiful. They're different every day. They change, don't you know? It depends on the light and the weather and the breeze and the mood of the person what's doing the looking. Some folks says the breeze rustling through the bottle sounds like chimes or handbells. Some folks says people's tears finds their way into the bottles, and when the wind skips across their lips in a certain way, it sounds like crying. I spec that's right in Pert Wilson's case. She were restless that and couldn't never seem to sleep at night. When she were just a bitty thing, I could hear her calling out in the middle of the night, calling for her daddy. Funny thing about that, most children's calls out for their mama, don't you know? The bottles on my bottle tree is just like family. They got names and stories. I spec my bottles got spirits, too. Don't you know that one of them's named for Pert Wilson? And that's Alice Wilson, trailer two. The next voice that steps out of the narrative is a retired school teacher. Her name is Sophie Mulch. Oh, laws, a trailer court's the dullest place in this world, and I'd have died of boredom long ago if it hadn't been for Pert Wilson. I had the only TV in the court, and when we could, we'd watch the soaps together. We'd count the number of lies the people told each other in every episode. When Pert first thought of this game, we used to count a half-truth as a whole lie. But there used to be so many of them, we couldn't keep up. A trailer court's no place for a child. I swanny, there wasn't a swing or a slide in sight. You'd cut your feet if you went barefoot, which Pert did spring and summer. I bought her a new pair of school shoes at the Tom McCann in Troy every fall. Ray Jean put up a fuss about it the first year I did it, but I said it was my pleasure. I retired from school teaching some years ago, and buying Pert Wilson new school shoes helps an old lady keep her corners up. I, swanny, I thought of Pert Wilson as my grandchild and Ray Jean Wilson as my own daughter. Ray Jean, bless her sweetheart, had more than her share of heartache. Her husband ran off right after Pert was born. He sent her money now and again, and most folks thought Ray Jean lived on the hope that he'd come back. But I'd bet my last nickel that Ray Jean only wanted him back because of Pert. Pert Wilson missed her daddy like the devil. Laws, but Wilson's made me feel like kin. Had me over when they played Monopoly. I swanny, it was the closest thing they ever had to money in their hands. Pert gambled like a sailor, buying up everything in sight till she'd gone broke. They always let me be banker, and I never bought cheap properties like Oriental Avenue or Baltic. Bought those greens and blue ones, Park Place, Pennsylvania Avenue. I like to see my dollar spent on improvements to my properties, so I was pleased as punch when I could buy a house or a hotel. I swanny Happy Trails could use a few improvements, too. I wish the police would catch those vandals that slashed the side of my trailer last spring. I had the only leather-sided trailer in the park. Bought it with part of my teacher's retirement. Now it looks like a vinyl sofa with a foam rubber popping out. Vandals makes it hard on the rest of us in Happy Trails, trying to live a decent life. And the last one I picked for you is a man. This is Eugene Nugent, trailer 9. Ray Jean doesn't know her daughter smokes, but I've seen Pert Wilson slipping off into the woods for a cigarette lots of times. I usually go out at night to walk Sarge. That's my black lab. A dog's better company than most people, if you ask me. Sometimes I see the red tip on the end of Pert's cigarette like a signal flare. Got a metal plate in my head after I got back from Korea. On permanent disability now. Use the plate to screw the two parts of my brain back together. Works fine, thank you very much. The hell of it was, one of my own buddies did it. Thought I was the enemy and fired away. Best thing about living in a trailer court is that nobody bothers you. I watch people, but I don't say much. Only time I go out is Friday nights. That's my bowling night. It's all the people contact I can take, thank you. Almost made it to the state championship last year. Would have, too, if I'd made that split on the last frame. I can see Pert Wilson smoking out there now. I figure she's entitled to whatever pleasure she can snatch. She's had a full plate of trouble. But I always liked the way Pert walked, tall and proud, tucking the newspaper up under her arm and sashaying across the court. always admired that gal. Knew what it was to hold your head up and not give in to the shame. Since she was a tiny thing, Pertz brought me my newspaper every day. Always give her a goo-goo cluster for the trouble. I like the idea of putting something sweet in that girl's life, even if it is just chocolate and peanuts.
Trudy Krischer, reading from her novel Kinship. This is WISO Weekend.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. President Obama was in Ohio again this week, and now we're less than 100 days from the election in November. Today, I'm joined by Jim Messina. He's the campaign manager for the Obama campaign. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So can you tell me, what does the Obama campaign look like on the ground level here in the state?
Well, look, we have the largest grassroots campaign, we think, in Ohio history. We already have over 50 field offices open. We'll be over 60 by next week across Ohio. Our goal is to build a neighborhood team structure that is able to get out there, register people, persuade them, and make sure folks get out to vote. It's all designed on our theory that, you know, politics is local. We want to have a local discussion with folks across Ohio about where they want to take this country and the choice they have in November.
There was an email sent out this past week from Vice President Joe Biden, and he really didn't mince words. He says if Obama doesn't win this election, it's because because they weren't able to close the spending gap. And indeed, Romney is raising more money in many swing states. So how concerned are you about fundraising?
Well, look, the Supreme Court Citizens United case allowed for the first time in American political history unlimited spending by corporations and wealthy individuals. And what you've seen is an explosion in outside money that doesn't need to be reported. You know, people writing $1 million and $10 million checks. The airwaves have been flooded across Ohio with a record amount of spending. And, you know, the president's going to be the first incumbent president ever to be outspent. And that just is what it is. We think the best way to combat that is person-to-person, door-to-door, grassroots campaign across Ohio to talk about the issues. You know, we'll have enough TV ads. Where we're going to win this is on the doors, and we're excited about it.
I do want to talk about the television ads for a second. There was a New York Times article this past weekend that was talking about the fact that the president's ads are on the negative side. In fact, I think out of all the ads, it's a 2-to-1 ratio of negative to positive ads. Why is that?
Well, look, the very first ads we ran this campaign in May, we did the largest buy ever of positive ads, over $30 million, to kind of lay out the president's, you know, what he inherited in 2008, the problems, and what he's done to move us forward. And then, you know, the super PAC spending started and went right at us. And, you know, we're not going to lie there and take it. We're going to push back. And that's an important thing to do to make sure people understand the truth. And, you know, there are real differences on the policy issues between us and Governor Romney. And we're going to be very clear about those differences. You know, we'll continue to be very, very forceful in our argument against Governor Romney, but I think you'll see us as well talk about where the president wants to take this. What is more important than all those TV ads is a huge grassroots campaign across this country. And, you know, in Ohio, we have a little bit over 2 months to be registered to vote. You must be registered by October 9th. Early voting starts on October 2nd. In the run-up to November 6th on Election Day. So, you know, we think as many as a third of all voters in Ohio will vote early, and that is a really important process to make sure your vote is counted and heard.
Just to stick with the negative ads thing for just a minute, it is kind of a departure from the 2008 election, and I just am wondering, is there a concern that it might alienate voters?
Well, look, I think voters understand that, you know, the president is laying out a clear vision of what he wants to do for this country. And, you know, as I said, both ads we have on right now are positive ads of the president talking to camera. You know, I think voters also understand there are clear differences between the president and his opponent. You know, a recent study came out that said that 98% of all the super PAC ads are negative, literally 98% are negative against the president. You know, we were being outspent in every media market. And I think folks understand that the other side is trying to buy this election. And, you know, there are differences between us and Governor Romney, and we're going to talk about those differences.
Speaking of Republican challenger Mitt Romney, he has not yet selected his running mate. One name that's floated around is Ohio Senator Rob Portman. What is the, if that is indeed the choice, what would the campaign strategy be here in Ohio?
Well, history teaches us that the vice presidential pick, you know, is not essential in the home state of the vice president. I think of the last 17 vice presidential picks, 10 of them didn't win their home states. That said, you know, we're going to continue to be very clear about Governor Romney and his intent to raise taxes on the middle class and lower taxes on the wealthiest 1 or 2% of Americans. And so, you know, I think that's a clear choice. In the vice presidential pick, you know, I don't think Governor Romney's going to ask me who he should pick, but I think whoever he picks won't really change the complexion of the race. This is a race between the president and Governor Romney.
I've been speaking with Jim Messina. He is the campaign manager for the Obama campaign. I appreciate you being here today.
Thanks very much. Have a great day.
That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.